I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing another one of our live streams, and we have decided that we are going to do weekly live streams from now to the end of the year, and that this is going to be how Countercurrents Radio functions in this new world where live streaming is a big thing. We will do a few pre-recorded interviews with various guests that we just can't get on the live stream itself, but I want to do these live streams because, well, they're fun. They build a sense of community. There's actual interaction with the people who are watching, listening. And so I think that's valid. And I also want to do basically live streamathons, fundraisers, because we have a fundraiser going. And Countercurrents has basically been deplatformed from selling books all over the world. We were deplatformed first last year by Amazon, then Barnes & Noble followed. That means that we are not available to 80% of the global book market. Okay, we thought we'll just sell things through our own platform. Well, we have been blacklisted from the credit card processing industry. And that basically just sent book sales to almost nothing. So I thought, well, let's be philosophical about this. We are going to take all the time and energy that we spent publishing books, and we're going to put it all into our webzine and podcasts and live streams, because that has always been how we've had the greatest impact. So that's what we're doing. The trouble is, of course, that all of this content we're producing is free stuff on the internet, and people don't like to pay for free stuff on the internet unless you really ask them. Last year, we had more than 1 million unique visitors to Countercurrents and only a bit more than 500 donors, keeping the whole thing afloat. We're trying to increase that number of donors. We have a significantly increased number of people listening to us now, reading us now. A lot of that has been driven by the recent unrest in America. I've gained more than, I think, 2,500 Twitter followers in the last month, which is good. We have seen our traffic going back up. The traffic was actually fairly high earlier this year. And then Google started trying to basically suppress it. They started monkeying with search engine results. But that was a little more than a month and a half ago that they did that. By the beginning of this month, all the strife that was going on in the United States had basically undone Google's attempts to suppress us, and our traffic started going way back up. So we have a lot of new people listening. We have a lot of opportunities to reach out to people and red pill people. And we also want to get some of those people activated as donors to keep this whole thing afloat. So we're doing these telethons. They used to call them telethons when they were on television. I want to call it a live streamathon. And we're going to have special guests for each one of these things. We have Jim Goad coming up in the future. We're going to have Kevin McDonald on, Sam Dixon, Morgoth, and many, many others. And the first of our special guests, though, is Laura Towler from the UK.
Thank you very much, Greg. And it's my pleasure to be here, especially as the first guest. I'm a huge fan of yourself and Countercurrents. So, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the stream. I know we've got some interesting topics as well.
Yes. Well, we have been so overwhelmed in the States with literal riots. We've got a revolution going on top of an economic depression and a public health crisis. So, and then the Republican Party really is just defaulting on all leadership and discrediting itself. So we've got at least four crises converging in the States. And yet we cannot overlook the fact that the United States leads the world in many ways. And shockingly enough, people in Europe are following along down the same path to destruction that we have blazed in America. And the UK, Cuck Island, as some of our friends like to call it, Airstrip One, you guys seem to have it the worst. And I just wanted to check in with you and talk to you about some of the recent experiences there, especially with all the anti-white racism and the Black Lives Matter protests and things like that. But before we go any further, it's tea time on the East Coast in America. And I want to talk about Yorkshire tea, because okay. you became a sort of tea drinker non grata, I understand. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I kind of feel like I experienced what it was like to be Katie Hopkins for about 3 days. I was like the most hated woman in Britain. But I just tweeted saying that I was really happy that my favourite brand of tea, Yorkshire Tea, hadn't virtue signalled about Black Lives Matter. And the reason why I was happy about that was because, number one, I'm just sick of brands getting political and thinking that they can, you know, like just get extra sales and like get all these extra brownie points and stuff for saying something virtuous. None of them ever do anything. It's just this Twitter virtue signaling that annoys me. And then the other reason was because I don't support Black Lives Matter. I don't know if you want to get into that, but there are plenty of reasons why I don't support them. And I was happy that my favourite brand of tea, which I've been loyal to all my life, and all my family members are loyal to them as well, I was happy that they seemed to be one of the few companies that weren't bowing down to BLM. And I'm not really sure how this happened, because they replied to me 2 days later and I didn't even tag them, but they told me never to buy their tea again. Because they stand against racism and they were educating themselves before they take proper action. I'm not really sure what proper action a tea brand has to take. And then they did the hashtag Black Lives Matter hashtag. And for some reason, it became international news. It was trending as the top news story in Britain. It reached the New York Times and CBS. I woke up the next morning and Piers Morgan was talking about it on Good Morning Britain. Owen Jones was talking about it. James Corden made a video about it. It was in newspaper articles in France, Germany, Austria, India. It was just worldwide news, just because I said I don't support BLM. And Yorkshire Tea told me not to buy their tea again. But it was just mental. I mean, I probably only read about maybe 1% or less of the messages that I got. And there was obviously a lot of hate, you know, a lot of people calling me a Nazi and a white supremacist and stuff. But we just got so much support as well. And the Patriotic Alternative website, I don't know if you want to talk about Pierre, but it's our IRL movement in Britain. I'm the deputy leader and the web editor of it. We got 48,000 new visitors to the website that morning. And I kind of braced myself thinking, oh, I'm going to have a look at the comments. I bet they're all negative and hateful and stuff. But it was all entirely supportive. And my Twitter followers as well, after being stagnant for about the last year, my Twitter subs shot up about 5,000. And we've just had so much support because of it. So what we're talking about now is using the media to our advantage and pulling more stunts like this. Although in this circumstance, I did actually do by accident, but it seems to be working, you know, bringing people over to our ideas and stuff.
Yeah, it's a massive example of them owning themselves. And this is how we fight, right? We don't have control of the media. We don't have control over social media platforms. We don't have billions of dollars in capital, but we can get the people who do to publicize us because they think that they're going to gain all this advantage by virtue signaling against poor Laura Towler, who just wants to enjoy a cup of tea, right? And it really blew up in their face. So yeah, so I'm hoping you're going to do this at least once a month. You know, come up with a list of your favorite brands and see if they will, if they'll vilify you. And of course, just bring people to your platform.
Yeah, well, we're trying to do Colgate toothpaste now. I don't know if you've seen the memes on Twitter, but their branding is, it says stuff like get whiter teeth in 14 days and stuff like enjoy dazzling whiteness all year round. So we're trying to meme them now, but they're not responding. So I don't know if they've learned their lessons. But it's already been copied quite a few times. We've had a couple of football clubs come out and disavow us. There was I think Martin Selner got a waffle company in Austria to do the same. There was a coffee brand yesterday that came out and disavowed us. So we just need like the mainstream media to pick them up in articles. And before we know it, we get free publicity. They actually used a picture of me in the Daily Mail, and it was the picture of me from the last Patriotic Alternative conference, and it had the PA logo in the background of the picture. So I was really happy that they did that.
That's wonderful. So tell us a bit about Patriotic Alternative, because I think it's a very important project and I want it to grow and flourish. So how are you doing now and what are you doing?
Yeah, it's just mental at the moment. So it's myself and Mark Collett run it. He's the leader and I'm the deputy leader. I'm also the web editor as well. It's an IRL movement, so we do things like community building and networking. We have different groups all around the UK, and we also do activism. So we made a documentary last year called We Were Never Asked, where we went out and surveyed the public on how they felt about us becoming a minority in Britain, and an overwhelming majority of people agreed with us. But we also have like conferences, camping trips. We actually went on an escape room trip recently, you know, just stuff like that, because it's just such a white pill to be among your own people, be able to speak freely, feel like you're not alone. So the community building side of it is a big side of it. But then we also have the political route as well. So we've submitted a bid to be a political party. We're not expecting to become prime minister and, you know, save the West or whatever. But we're expecting to maybe stand in some local elections, move the Overton window a little bit, help wake some people up on the way. But then on the political side as well, we also have things like the alternative curriculum, which is a project that we just started last month. But we have about 20 teachers working on it, male and female, from early years up to PhD level. And we're basically providing homeschooling material for any parents who want to homeschool their children. That'll all be available to download for free on the PA website. So there's loads going on at the moment. And Mark and I are at the stage now where we just can't do anything else more than we're doing, because there aren't enough hours in the day. So I think in the future, we haven't taken any donations yet, but we are going to start taking some donations so we can get some staff, you know, to do admin and stuff, so that Mark and I can start other projects as well. But it's just going really well, and we've had thousands and thousands of people sign up and say they want to get involved in activism and, you know, leaflet and stuff like that. So it's just a really nice positive community to be part of, and it seems to be going well so far.
That's really very encouraging. I'm glad to hear that. So what kind of web traffic are you getting now? You said that it went up substantially recently.
Yeah, so we only launched the website I think about 2 months ago. And most of the articles have like a few thousand views at least. We do share them on our Twitter and on our Telegram and on our Facebook. With regards to how many clicks we get per day, I'm honestly not sure at all. But I know that we got 48,000 on the Yorkshire Tea Day, 48,000 new visitors. But it does seem to be going up from, you know, when we launched a couple of months ago. One thing I do know, because the tech guy told me this, is that we are the highest ranking nationalist website in the UK. So we're actually ranking higher on, I think it's Amazon's Alexa, than For Britain, Britain First, and even UKIP and the BNP as well. So we are ranking higher than them already. So I guess we just need to keep doing what we're doing and filling up the website with content and, you know, getting the clicks on there as well.
Well, there is kind of a vacuum. I mean, there has been a vacuum since the BNP basically collapsed. And metapolitically, for years, I thought that the London Forum was a good thing that was happening, but everyone was waiting for something more of, to, you know, less people standing up and giving speeches and then socializing around it, and more opportunities for activism. So I'm really glad that this group has come along and it seems to be getting off to a good start.
Yeah, it's like that meme, isn't it? Have you seen the one where there's the guy sat at the desk and he's just reading a book or doing some writing or something, and a guy comes to the window dressed in like some knight's uniform or something and says, "It's time." And then the guy's like, "Right, okay, let's get up and do it." And I feel like for a long time, a lot of us have been sat waiting for something to happen. You know, we make YouTube videos and then people say, "Well, what are you doing about it? You know, how are you trying to change the country?" And for a long time, we've not been able to say anything. But now we have this movement, and I do feel like a lot of people have been waiting for something like this, and that's why we've had such a influx of interest, really. And we've also had a lot of people who have moved to us from, say, the Tommy Robinson movement or For Britain movement, and they've told us that they were with those other movements because they were the best thing that was available at that time. But now a real nationalist movement is available. They've come straight to us. So, it's going well, as you say.
Well, they want the real thing. They don't want the ersatz, fake nationalists. And you guys are real, but you're also sensible and sane and have great optics. And I think that counts a great deal as well. One question that we got, and I promised the reader that we would deal with this, and I talked about it with you earlier, is this question of what can we do? What can we do right now? So many of us are literally imprisoned in our own homes. We don't have jobs to go to. But we look out the window and we see the streets are thronging with rioters and looters and joggers. And we want to do something. We want to raise consciousness because this is a moment when a lot of people are looking for alternative views. They see what's happening. They're not comfortable. What can we do? Can you talk about some of the practical things? Recently, for instance, I reposted an article on reigniting It's Okay to Be White, which I think is a great campaign. I think White Lives Matter is a great message, as we saw with that banner that was towed in the UK. Can you think of some things that you would suggest that people do in the privacy of their own homes or within their own social circles to open people's minds and shake things up a bit?
Yeah, well, one thing I will say is because I manage the PA website, I deal with all the incoming inquiries. And there are so many people who have been waking up over the last couple of weeks. And it's because of things like our statues being torn down. That's one thing that's really, really upset people. And another one, believe it or not, which has really, really upset people is football teams kneeling. People are just so against being told to kneel for BLM. So people are waking up and we're getting a lot of messages from people who aren't even nationalists who are saying, I like what you guys are saying. And I really do feel like the establishment or whatever we want to call them have overplayed their hand. And we talk a lot, don't we, about the boiling frog, but it's like the last 2 weeks they've just cranked up the heat and people are just like, no, I'm not having this. But I think the best thing that we can do is just don't go down to the riots and get involved and counter protest and all that stuff. Just point people's eyes in the direction of what's happening. So share things like the statement from Burnley Football Club, who said that the White Lives Matter banner was disgusting. Show that to people, or share the photos of, if you're in Britain, the Labour Party, who was supposed to be the party who represent the working class, kneeling down and, you know, uploading it to social media for virtue points. Or share the different responses from the police and the government and say, look, why are these people allowed to protest and break COVID rules, but these people aren't allowed to do it? Just highlight the hypocrisy. I honestly think that's the best thing that we can do. But another thing, you know, as we've already touched on, is using the media to our advantage. Try and get brands and football clubs and companies and stuff to virtue signal, and then try and get the media to talk about it and draw attention our way. And one other thing that I will say as well, is personally, I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to take that step back from shopping with these big global companies and buying local produce. So I live with my fiance and we try to do this anyway, like we'll get our meat from the butchers, but we can definitely do better. And we were talking the other day and saying, you know, we need to start buying from entirely from brands who don't support BLM and don't hate us. And I just think this is the perfect opportunity for people to maybe reconsider who they're spending their money with, cancel your Netflix subscriptions. I think even computer games like Call of Duty and stuff have got BLM flashed up in the corner. Just stop giving money to all these brands that hate us. And it's a perfect opportunity for us to start investing in local businesses, you know, and that money going back into the community. So I hope those are okay answers. Those are some of the things that I've been doing recently.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think all of that's good. I do want to emphasize something you said because it's so important. And I've been saying this ever since this began. If you're a racially conscious white person, do not get involved in counter protests. There are simple reasons for this. One, in the United States, there is no equality under the law. There is no equality before the law. Blacks and their allies, leftists, basically anarchists, communists, have carte blanche to riot. They have a get out of jail free card, basically. You don't have that. You will not be shown the same consideration. In fact, early on in this, this idiot mayor in Minneapolis, who's got a lot of blood on his hands because of his stupidity and his weakness, he actually tried to float the laughable idea that the violence was coming from white supremacists, right? Totally ridiculous idea. It sort of got laughed at and has been quietly dropped, but then it comes back up. They're trying to support this idea. Don't give them anything to use to support this stupid narrative that the violence is being caused by quote-unquote white supremacists. Just don't do that. Remember what happened in Charlottesville. Remember James Fields. Do not become the next James Fields. The system right now is battling with itself, basically. Black Lives Matter anarchists, Antifa are privileged people in the UK. They're privileged people in the United States. But like many people of privilege, they don't feel privileged enough. They're having a giant tantrum. They have impossible demands. They're not even sure what they really want, but they have all kinds of impossible demands that they want to tender. And they're just going to riot and burn and destroy as much as they can. But that's coming at the expense of the system that supports them and hates us. And my feeling is that when you see two enemies fighting, the natural thing to do is to try and separate them. And that's what we really need ultimately. We need racial and ethnic separation so we don't have this conflict. But when you have two enemies fighting and you will be punished brutally, viciously, and dishonestly for trying to be, you know, basically a decent person exercising his civic duty, right? You don't be a sucker. Don't let that happen. Let the system fight itself. Let the system weaken itself. When you see your enemies making a mistake, and in this case, it's two groups of enemies, don't interrupt them, as Napoleon said. So I do think that that's just a very, very important message that we just have to constantly repeat. Don't get involved in actual counter-protests, but there are many, many things that we can do. And yeah, educate. Point out the hypocrisies and double standards. A lot of people think, oh, that's so elementary. Yes, it is elementary. But there are so many new people coming in, and we have to get things down to basics. Just getting people aware of the massive double standards, all of which are anti-white, and yet are being justified with a completely inverted false narrative that whites are the ones who have privilege. It's very, very shocking to a lot of people to see this. It's so clear now. They can't deny it. So I do think that's important. But one thing I want to talk about are things that we can do a little bit of safely, quietly. Take whatever level of risk you're comfortable with. But there are things that we can do to agitate this a little bit more. And I want to talk about specifically this fellow who flew the White Lives Matter banner. Can you give us some discussion of that? Because that, I think, was a massive self-own by the establishment, their reaction to the White Lives Matter Burnley banner.
Yeah, so it was by a young man called Jake Heppel. And I think, Jake Heppel is a Tommy Robinson fan. So I don't necessarily think he's a nationalist or anything like that, but he is a fan of Tommy Robinson. And he flew a banner with a plane over, I think it was the Etihad Stadium. I think Burnley must have been playing Manchester City away. And he flew this banner over it while the players were kneeling for Black Lives Matter. And, you know, rather than just ignoring it, because the media can never ignore it, can they? They always have to show us how disgusted they are. They published all these articles about, you know, how it was white supremacist and all that rubbish that they come out with all the time. And the football club was forced into issuing a statement about it, and they called it disgusting. They said that the banner was disgusting, and all it said was "White Lives Matter, Burnley." The guy responded to it absolutely perfectly because he refused to apologise, and he said something like, "George Floyd was killed, and we've had, you know, worldwide protests around about dismantling the police and all this stuff. Everyone's crying about it, but we had three people stabbed and murdered in Reading by a foreigner." The week after, I think it was, or last week to us. And so white lives do matter and white lives are at risk. And he was like, why is it a different response to George Floyd to white people when they're stabbed by foreigners? But like you said, the media have just completely overplayed their hands because they hated it. They went into a complete meltdown about it. And it's one of those things, again, it's just woken up so many people. Like I say, I deal with the incoming inquiries at PA, and so many people have mentioned that banner and said, like, why do white lives not matter? Why are we not allowed to speak about this? But the guys handled it so well. And that does seem to be the one statement at the moment, white lives matter, that they're really not happy with, because they always say, you know, when we say Black Lives Matter, it doesn't mean that white lives don't matter, it just means that Black Lives Matter. And it's like, well, do you not see the irony in you saying that we can't say White Lives Matter then? Because it's nothing to do with black people. We're not saying that black lives don't matter, we're just saying what about our people as well? You know, we care about our people. So yeah, like you said, it backfired.
You know, the reaction to saying all lives matter is really interesting. You can't say all lives matter. You can't say white lives matter. So that basically means that only Black lives matter, right? That's the message. Only Black lives matter. There's so many lies that underline these protests, and nobody publicly in the establishment will stand up and speak the truth. Lie number one, Black people are significantly endangered by white people. Well, that's just not true. If you look at racial crime statistics, white people are at far greater danger from Black crime than Black people are in danger from white crime. The claim that policemen are especially dangerous to Black people is again false. First of all, Blacks are far more dangerous to policemen than policemen are dangerous to Blacks. And beyond that, in the United States at least, the police under-police Blacks already and over-police whites. So if you are a white person, you are significantly more likely to be killed or injured in an interaction with the police than Blacks. These are just facts. These are well-known facts. And the other great lie that Black Lives Matter puts out there is the idea that Black lives just don't matter enough to white people. The truth of the matter is that Black lives matter more to white people than they do to Blacks. Blacks hold Black life very, very cheap. And really, the only Black lives that matter, as far as the Black Lives Matter movement are concerned, are Black lives that can be used to push an anti-white narrative and to push anti-white political policies. They don't care about Black-on-Black crime, which is enormous. They care about white-on-Black crime or things that aren't even crimes. That's the thing that's also shocking. The claim that this Ahmaud Arbery guy was the victim of murder, it's just false. These people should never have been charged with anything. Self-defense, clear case. George Floyd, there's absolutely no evidence that he died because of any kind of improper policing. It's simply a lie. Or this fellow in Atlanta, this guy tried to steal the weapon. He stole a weapon from a police officer and tried to use it on him and got shot. And now they've arrested the officer for felony murder, which carries a potential death penalty. All of these claims are lies. And yet not even our hated racist extremist president will just stand up and say these are lies. And so it's very, very frustrating. And I know why people want to get out there and counter-protest. Just speak the truth. That's triggering enough. And there are some things that you can do, like if you want to tow a banner, well, this guy got fired from his job. His girlfriend got fired from his job. I'm glad they stood up. They didn't apologize. That's the right thing to do. Never apologize for telling the truth. Never apologize for doing the right thing. Never kneel to this mob. But if you want to do something quieter, you know, stickers and flyers and things like that, you know, deface Black Lives Matter stuff by slapping a White Lives Matter sticker on it, that might be seen by 5 or 10 people. But if one of those people thinks that there must be some kind of law against this and calls the police and then the media get involved, suddenly that'll be seen by tens of thousands of people. You know, the hilarious thing is when you see an entire building completely defaced with graffiti and the media cameras zero in on the tiny White Lives Matter sticker. It's like a microcosm of how selective this all is, how selective their outrage is, how twisted their perspective is. So I'm a big supporter of reviving It's Okay to Be White, or using the same techniques as It's Okay to Be White to do just White Lives Matter. Yeah. Tell us a bit about 100 Handers and some of the work they do in the UK, because I think that that's something that definitely should be supported.
Yeah, so the 100 Handers are an anonymous sticker group where somebody releases kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a document with all the stickers on. I think it's once per month he releases them, an archive, that's what it's called. And you can just basically go onto the archive and you buy this certain printer, which is quite cheap to buy. And then you can print out thousands of these stickers and it's really, really cheap. And like you've just said, you know, a few people might see the sticker, but then the media pick up on them and they absolutely hate the 100-handers. And the stickers are just things like, you know, it's okay to be white, or things like 3% of the population, 12% of the prison population, stuff like that. It's just really sort of innocuous stuff which aren't offensive at all. There's never encouraging violence. It's just things like, you know, statistics, facts from the government. 19,000 English girls were sexually abused by predominantly Pakistani Muslim men in England last year, things like that. But they're really sort of short, snappy stickers which catch your eye, not like big essays or anything. But the media hate them, and the media, whenever they find one of these stickers, they publish articles about it. I remember reading a really funny one last year of somebody had seen a sticker and then phoned their local councillor, and their local councillor went over to the sticker, which was on this bin or trash can, as you guys call them, and he crouched down next to this little bin and he was pointing at the sticker with this really sort of like upset look on his face, and then it went out into the media. And of course it just looks ridiculous, because the sticker said something like it's okay to be white. It was really, you know, not offensive at all. And then some people will be like moral outrage over them, and then other people will be like, but there's nothing wrong with those stickers, and it just gets a dialogue going. But it's really good, and I'm not sure how many hands there are, because the whole thing is completely anonymous, but we've seen stickers in pretty much every Western country that you can think of. And just to go back very quickly to the point that you made before about BLM lying, it's exactly the same with Britain. We have the stop and search. I don't know if you guys have that, but they're always going on saying that stop and search is racist. Black people are overrepresented in stop and search, but then they're also overrepresented in arrests, charges, convictions and prison sentences, by 400% actually with prison sentences. So the police are actually stop and searching the right people, but they don't like it. They're just like, oh, blacks are doing it more, so the police must be racist. And as you said, like, as a matter of statistical fact, Black Lives Matter significantly less to other black people than anyone else, because I think it's something like 92% of black people who are murdered by other black people. And you never hear BLM talking about that. But yeah, it's just exactly the same in both of our countries. Do you mind if I ask you a quick question?
Sure, sure.
I wondered what you thought of Tucker Carlson, because he's been talking about BLM quite a lot recently and he seems to be doing some good work.
Yeah, well, Tucker Carlson is a heroic figure in my view. He's the only honest conservative journalist there is, which is a shocking thing in and of itself. There should be more of them, but there aren't. And I strongly admire the guy. I mean, he has a huge amount of pressure, I think, being arrayed against him to go along with this narrative. The Republican Party in the United States is utterly cowardly and cucked. And the reason why they're utterly cowardly and cucked on these particular issues is because ultimately the only thing they really care about is economics. And if they have a corner of their heart for nationalism, well, it's Zionism. That's enough for them. They are committed to the idea that the United States is merely an economic zone and occasionally something that can be used to basically advance Jewish geopolitical interests. That's all that is to them. And it's completely consistent with their conception of America to flood it with non-whites, to basically jettison American history and American identity. And so that's why they just don't care. They can't be bothered to really stand up against the destruction of American history, the destruction of American monuments. And of course, ideas mean almost nothing to Republicans. They're called the stupid party for a reason. And so for decades, America has been impeached over and over again with increasing radicalism by tenured parasites in universities all the way down to kindergartens. And Republicans will do nothing about this. They will not fight the culture war. We have state-subsidized anti-American propaganda from kindergarten through PhD level that is sacrosanct. The libertarian mentality that a lot of these people have, or at least that they appeal to, basically to as an excuse not to do anything, is utterly absurd. Basically, the Republican Party piously promises their voters to not use state power for the interests of their voters. And we wonder why they always lose. We wonder why everything goes to the left. We need a new statist right in America that will use state power. Now, Tucker Carlson doesn't seem to be beholden at all to these stupid Republican ideas. He's populistic. He's nationalistic. He was a big Trump supporter early on for all the right reasons. And he's, I think, utterly disgusted with the Republican Party. And he's utterly dismayed with Trump because Trump was changed by the Republican Party. As we hoped he would change the Republicans, but the Republicans have changed him. From the very beginning, he was always a civic nationalist, and he increasingly bought this Republican Kool-Aid that they can basically put all of their effort into avoiding being called racists by people who hate them and who throw that word around unjustly without any cause anyway. And so he has constantly pandered to blacks. It's all this low black unemployment, enterprise zones, all this stuff. Not requited by votes. He's always going on about the minorities. He's never talking about white voters and white interests. He's never talking about the people who put him in office, right? Including people who suffered a great deal to support him. So he's a huge disappointment. Tucker Carlson is listened to by Trump. We know this. He's been able to influence Trump to do good things in the past. But at this point, Trump's behavior is just so inexplicably hapless and really demoralizing. And I see him getting angrier and angrier with every passing broadcast. He's a very courageous guy. His heart's in the right place. And I think increasingly he just wants to talk about race realism, but there are truths that he cannot say and keep his job. The truths that we outlined about race and crime and stuff like that. So I think he's a fine person. I think he's a person of courage. He's really the best thing on the American right today. Tucker Carlson and Ann Coulter, two people I have great admiration for. And I hope they just keep speaking the truth. And maybe others will go along with them. But they have to feel really, really lonely right now, even though they have huge, adoring audiences. Within the establishment, they're very lonely. And that means that at any time, they can be deplatformed. They can be cut off. Basically, some smoke-filled room or some dinner meeting in some exclusive club or just a phone call from one person to another. You know how that works. Suddenly, he might be gone. I don't know what will happen if he is fired from Fox. I think what he should do is start the Joe Rogan podcast of the right. I think he would be enormously popular. Rush Limbaugh is going to be dead soon. He should take his place, and he should also consider just running for office someday. He should build a movement around himself. And when he's free to speak the full truth, we'll see how much he knows. I think things are only going to get better, though, in terms of polarization, which we want. We want more polarization because it basically evacuates the middle, evacuates the center, and forces people to be honest. And that's really hard for a lot of people who have been propagandized and basically psychologically abused all their lives by the left. I mean, somebody needs to write a book about the psychology of the right. It's basically the psychology of an abused spouse. And these people have been so whipped and gelded and abused, it's going to take a huge amount of work to get them to just do what they're supposed to do. do their jobs, for God's sake, right?
Yeah, I definitely think that Tucker Carlson is very brave. I know people complain sometimes that he's not like 100% our guy, but I think sometimes people don't understand like how hard it can be out there and how at risk you are as well. And I think he is just right for his audience. He doesn't go too far to scare people away, but he definitely is slightly outside the mainstream Overton window. And I saw that he'd lost 6 advertisers or something because of his rant about BLM and them funding the Democrats or something. And then just to comment on your comment about Trump, he keeps saying stuff on Twitter and then people are retweeting him saying, we'll do something about it then. Like, he just complains on Twitter, but then he never seems to do anything about it. And there's no doubt that his hands are tied, but I don't know, do you think he'll win again, or what's the feeling? I don't really follow him in politics.
Yeah, things are so unstable right now that who can tell? For years, basically, I have held that this election is the Democrats to lose. Trump really had to hit the ground running at the beginning of his term and get a handle on immigration and voter fraud. He has failed to do that. And that means that the demographic clock kept ticking away. Trump voters kept dying, and new Democratic voters kept coming in the country, being registered. A lot of them will vote fraudulently. They don't have any reason to vote. The dead will get up and vote. People who voted their entire lives as Republicans have died in the last few years and now will vote Democrat for all eternity. It's just a crime. And Trump could have done something to stop this, but he would have had to have focused all of his energy on it. And he ran out of energy. And he also just let himself get distracted. He eventually just decided to do things that were easy. One of the things that's easy to do in American politics is give Israel whatever it wants. He did that. That's always easy. There's no resistance down that path. But actually doing something to help America, well, he had a bitter election campaign. He won by a tiny margin. And basically, it was an election campaign. It was a referendum on whether America is a nation or just an economic zone. And he barely won. I think a lot of the people who put him in office have died. I think a lot of them have been replaced by enemies. And I think that, or just turned into dead zombie voters for Democrats. So I really thought this was the Democrats to lose. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't stupid enough to lose it. And boy, are they behaving stupidly, right? The whole situation that we're in is basically this. You want to destroy a country. I've got the simplest way to destroy any country. Make it a taboo to say no to black people. They'll do the rest, right? They have unreasonable demands. They behave violently. And so on and so forth. If you can't say no to them, if you can't police them, they'll destroy any country. Well, the Democratic Party panders to blacks. They need the black vote. It's filled with blacks. And they can't say no to these people. And so we had the most ridiculous race, right? And we had the most ridiculous slate of candidates. And the one who won out, the guy that the Democratic Party chose out of more than 300 million Americans to be its standard bearer, is obviously senile. He's senile, and he's incompetent to be president. Now, we really are in a situation where the question is, in a few months, is America a joke of a country enough to elect a manifestly incompetent, senile man to be president? I mean, we've already had a really bad year. First coronavirus, then the economic recession, then Black Lives Matter with all the economic consequences of that too, and the social unrest and the default of the Republican Party, its legitimacy just being shredded. We're having spikes in COVID-19 again because of all the protests. America, if it elects a manifestly senile man, is just going to be a global joke, right? But it could happen. I just don't know. So many things are happening now, or could happen, because everything is totally unstable. But the thing that's amazing to me is that this could have been a magnificent opportunity for Trump to solidify his power. Well, first of all, the coronavirus thing could have been a magnificent opportunity for him to say, globalization has failed, open borders have failed, laissez-faire capitalism, selectively has failed. We need a strong state to take care of the public. instead of bailouts for billionaires, they could have voted universal basic income in. They could have done tons of great stuff that would be solidly populist and cement Trump's power. He completely flubbed all of that. Then this comes along. This is made to order for a quote-unquote authoritarian racist like Trump to actually save people. People feel great anxiety and horror after over what's going on. And it's not just Republicans. It's a lot of people in the center. They're not comfortable with the situation either. They're afraid. If Trump came forward to actually solve this, he would cement power and he might cruise to re-election. But he's not doing that. So it's just a completely open question what's going to happen. I just don't know. I can't imagine America being a joke country enough to elect Joe Biden. But look, if you have enough dead people and enough black people and enough brown people and enough completely insane shit libs to do it, that's what's going to happen, right? And I hope these people, once they put this guy in office, have a, oh my God, what have we done moment, right? But the thing that's really terrible, though, is we know that even if Trump gets reelected, things are just going to continue to decline if his present behavior is any indication. I think for me as a white nationalist, the best outcome would be for Trump to get reelected. And perhaps for the Senate and the House to go to the Democrats. So we have a completely divided government. The left will be going completely bananas. I mean, you haven't seen anything yet, if Trump gets reelected. And we could see the country breaking up. And I would love that. I would love it. One of the first things I wrote after Trump got elected was an essay called In Praise of Cal Exit. The idea of California leaving the union, because California is one of the worst states in America. It's a beautiful place to visit, used to be a lovely place to live, but it is chock full of fruits, nuts, and flakes, to use the old. It's the great American granola, and it's filled with tens of millions of non-whites, completely crazy shit libs. Many of the white people in California aren't even white by our standards. A lot of them are Middle Easterners and Jews and people like that. So it is one of the worst possible states. And if California and all of its electoral votes and tens of millions of non-whites stomped out of the union in protest of Donald Trump, it could change everything. It could almost make the rest of America salvageable just in and of itself. I would like to see Trump reelected just so these blue state secessionist movements really take off. They basically, a lot of people said, yeah, well, we'll just throw the bastard out in 2020. If they don't throw Trump out in 2020, I think there will be an enormous push for Balkanization of America. And if red states tried to secede from America, the New York Times would be demanding that nuclear bombs be rained down upon them, lest racism happen, right? If blue states decide to leave America, we'd get the same result, but we would do it painlessly because the left wants it, right? And whatever the left wants, it's easy. Whatever the right wants is racism and must be viciously, viciously suppressed. So yeah, I just don't know what's going to happen. And it's an absolutely fascinating situation. It's so unstable right now.
Yeah, if only Trump was as bad as all the people who hate him say he is.
Yeah, I wish he was.
Boris Johnson.
Yeah. Well, let me run through some of the donations and thank people, because this is a fundraiser. If you want to do a Super Chat paid donation through Entropy, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. That's one word, countercurrents. And make a donation, leave a comment, leave a question. We'll get to those. I'm going to assume that all these names are fake, but if I have any doubt, I'll just give like the first name. So I don't want to dox anybody here. James gives us $8. It's okay to be white is a powerful message. It is meek. Okay, meek and genuine. Now is the time to spread the message. Normal whites are starting to feel the white guilt and don't like it. It's okay to be white. I totally agree. What do you think, Laura?
Yes, I totally agree as well. I guess we've covered quite a lot of that in the stream, but people are feeling the pressure at the moment and they're looking for somewhere to turn. So we need to be welcoming these people with open arms.
Yeah, I agree. Gadius, who's one of our top donors and most faithful followers and supporters, writes in with $20. Miss Towler, gold, black Fred Perry polos are synonymous with Proud Boys now, to the chagrin of Fred Perry. Couldn't the same happen to Yorkshire Tea if Brit Nats embraced it despite how paused the company is?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm not 100% sure what direction we're going to go in yet, because I've left Yorkshire Tea as my cover photo on Twitter because I think it's kind of funny. I know it annoys him, so I've kept it up there. But I think Martin Selner once drank a smoothie in a video or something and he got sued by them for drinking it. So I'd have to look into the legalities of... Everyone was like, let's make Yorkshire Tea the official tea of Nazis. Let's just meme them into having a relationship with us. But yeah, I'm not sure. We need to decide what to do about it, I guess. But I don't want to spend any more money with them because they support BLM. But I guess we could, you know, maybe publicly drink the tea that we've already got and say that it's Yorkshire Tea or something.
Yeah, yeah. So Phil writes in with $5, thanks for being a positive voice for white people. That's to both of us, I assume. A Thin Red Line writes in with $15, thank you for all you do and do Greg Johnson and Countercurrents. Mr. James writes in with $25, happy belated birthday. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary back on the 11th. H writes in, what would you do with proper funding, say $1 billion? So this is a great question. So Laura, what would you do with $1 billion?
Oh gosh, well I've never thought about that before because I never expected to get anything like that. But I mean, at the moment, like I said, Mark and I have stretched Patriotic Alternative as far as it can be stretched between two volunteers. So if we did any more or took on any more projects, we literally wouldn't be able to sleep or like eat or anything because there just aren't enough hours in the day. So we'd like to have actual members of staff working at PA. In fact, you've said $1 billion and I'm starting off really small here, but I just think for the foreseeable future, I'd just like somebody to maybe take the burden away from me and Mark a bit so that we can focus on more the public side of things. The main thing for us is going to be community building, because we can attempt the political route as much as we want to, but there's a good chance that they're going to ban us. There's a good chance that we'll go to prison. There's a good chance that they'll stop us from getting in. And even if Matt Collett did become Prime Minister one day, those you know, puppet masters behind the scenes would probably stop him from being able to do what he wants to do. So we're going to try and go down the political route, but our focus has always been community building and creating safe communities for our people where our children can be safe and where we can feel like we're among our own. So maybe sort of like buying a street or something, you know, like all the property on a street and then starting a community from there. I think that would be really good, but I haven't really considered this much because it, you know, it's never something that I thought we'd have. But yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see how you would spend it at Countercurrents.
Well, somebody once asked me what I would do with $1 million, and I thought, well, I have to have a good answer to this because maybe this person was actually going to reach for a checkbook, right? If I were offered $1 million, the first thing I would do, though, is I'd create a back office of paid professional staff that basically would be shared by all the important content producers in the United States. And it would be a way of freeing up these content producers and making them more productive. I would have a professional person who just deals with web stuff, a professional IT guy. I'd have a professional fundraiser. I would have a graphic designer, somebody who does, you know, memes and dust jacket covers and little cards for, you know, propagating things through social media, that kind of stuff. People like that are golden. So that's what I would do. I'd have just an office manager to make sure that every piece of mail is opened and dealt with in a timely fashion, that all the state and federal forms are filed in a timely fashion. These things are absolutely important for just making sure that people can be productive and stay in the game. So that's what I do with $1 million. I would start out small, but I would create a staff of absolutely committed professional people that would make the thing move, you know, sort of in the back room, the back office, that would work like a well-oiled machine. Now, if I had a significant amount of money, like $1 billion, well, I think that's very simple. There are two things that I would do. First of all, I would find a way of creating a payment processing company that believed in freedom of speech. If you're a company operating in the United States, your only terms of service should be the First Amendment. And if we had a First Amendment payment processor and a First Amendment YouTube, I think that would be enormous. Those would be game changers for us. If we could have a free speech monetizable video blogging platform, that could change everything. And it could not be just a political thing. It could just foster a whole cultural renaissance in some ways. The great thing about YouTube in its golden age was that it allowed people to learn how to do it themselves and turn themselves into journalists, artists, influencers. It was a great thing. And it also had a built-in algorithm that led people to expand their horizons. Now, of course, they just wanted you to spend more time watching stuff, right? That's fine. But the algorithm worked to expand people's horizons. And that led many people from the mainstream to our content. Those days are over. That's very sad. There are a lot of people on YouTube, not even political people, who are sick of the direction that it's going. And if we had a platform that was free speech and monetizable and open, I think you would get lots and lots of people exiting YouTube and setting up on that new platform. And it would be enormously, enormously valuable politically. So yeah, those are the two things: a payment processor and a free speech monetizable video blogging platform. Yeah, it would be nice to have just a regular old social media thing. But honestly, you could build that in with the video processing platform, the video blogging platform. It would be great to have both your social media and your video stuff on the same desktop, frankly. And if somebody can do that, that'll be a great thing.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I've just thought of as well is people, I think that the biggest thing that's stopping people from being able to speak out is the fear of losing their job. And it would be good if we had a safety net for those people, because I mean, like Jake Heppel last week, who got fired, and his girlfriend as well, for just saying White Lives Matter. It would be good if people didn't have to fear speaking out, if we had legal costs for them, and if we had maybe a position at a company where they could go and at least earn enough money to support their family. I think that would be something that I would do as well.
Yeah, yeah. A third thing that would be very important, and if I had $1 billion, I'd definitely put some of that aside for this, would be some kind of public interest law firm that would help people. For years, we've seen instances where somebody just blunders into being honest and is attacked and canceled. And it's just become more and more intense recently. It would be nice if we had a team of people led by a really, really slick lawyer. And if somebody, like a public official, blunders into saying some truths and they're under attack, you can get to those people. You can get a meeting with them within 24 hours. You can have a legal team and you can sit them down and you can say, this is what you have to do. This is what won't work. This is what will work. We will help you. Because the thing is this, if we can get people to stand up against this pressure and not back down and not apologize, that encourages others. That's why they're attacked, because the people who run things don't want others to be emboldened. So they have to treat every dog catcher who says some truth about politics has to be canceled, has to be vilified, has to have their life ruined. They cannot rest. And we have to get these people to stand up. What would happen if somebody with the followership of, say, Rush Limbaugh actually decided on his next show to say the three truths that you can't say about what's going on, that whites are far less dangerous to blacks than blacks are to whites, that blacks are far more dangerous to police than police are to blacks, that police are more dangerous to whites than they are to blacks, and that black lives actually don't matter all that much to black people, and they have perhaps an inflated value to white people. If somebody actually said that and stood up, that could change everything. And this is what we need to do. We need to get people to stand up when they're under attack, and that encourages others. And if you can get enough people to stand up and realize that they're not in the minority, and in fact, they might be the majority, then everything can change really, really quickly. What's happening now is we basically have totalitarianism, where you have a false ideology that is intensely pushed by a minority, and the rest of the country goes along with it because they're intimidated. Very few people believe this stuff. Fewer people every day believe that diversity brings any good to our societies. It's just so obviously untrue. And yet they go along with it because they see people who buck the system being attacked. But the truth is, we are the majority. And if we realize that we're the majority and that we have the strength in numbers, then we can change everything. We can turn it all around. But it's just a matter of getting those brave or foolish people who break ranks with the majority, the establishment, to stand and not to fail, so that enough people can rally around them. If we can do that, we can change everything. And it's going to be a random thing. It'll be something that we can't predict, but we have to have people in place to basically stiffen the resistance of people who speak the truth and help them fight from being persecuted. There are all kinds of legal ways that you can fight against being discriminated against. There are all kinds of laws on the books that were put there to protect communists, but they protect us, right? We can actually, if we have the lawyers and the will and the organization, we can use these laws to protect our people and protect freedom of speech.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with everything that you've said. And that was quite a difficult question, because I've never thought what we would do with that much money, because we don't actually accept any donations at the moment. But like I said, we will do in the near future. But there's a lot of problems that we're facing that we could fix, I think, with money. And like you said, just even just paying for lawyers and, paying people salaries so that they don't lose out from telling the truth. That would be such a huge step forward, I think. That would be such a huge burden to get over.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So if you want to donate, we are taking donations. This is a streamathon, a Countercurrents fundraiser streamathon. Please go to https://entropystream.live/countercurrents. You can leave a donation, you can leave a comment, you can leave a question. You've got two big-brained people here that are just waiting to weigh in on your questions and comments. So don't let this opportunity go to waste. So I want to check and see if we've got some new things that have popped up in the DLive stream. Yes, so Burden has just donated an ice cream, and Exocet has just donated a diamond. That's excellent. So I want to scroll through some of the comments that we've gotten here on DLive. Okay, somebody wants to suggest Carpathos. Grow your own tea, grow mint in your backyard, grows like crazy and only needs shade and some moisture. This is true. And one of the nicest things in the world is if you can get mint growing like crazy, because it's a weed, but it smells so good. And it's actually quite beautiful. And yeah, you can make tea, you can put it in salads, you can season things with it. Somebody says Yorkshire tea reigns supreme. Okay.
Oh, well, have you seen what Yorkshire tea, not Yorkshire tea, what BLM UK said about Palestine earlier
on? Oh, no.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yes, you tweeted about that. Yeah. Give me your comments on that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just we were all just sat there with our popcorn wondering where this is going to go, which protected group is going to reign supreme, because basically BLM UK came out and said Free Palestine, we support Palestine. I think they said something about Jewish colonialism supremacists or something along that line, talking about the West Bank. And obviously they get a lot of support from Jewish people. And the comments were just absolutely flooded, saying, I supported you as a Jew, but now I know that you're anti-Semitic. I'm not supporting Black Lives Matter anymore. And our guys were just like, just sat enjoying the show, I guess, because...
Yeah. Get the popcorn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we need to declare our official brand of popcorn, right? Because we're going to be sitting back and eating a lot of popcorn as our enemies go at one another for a while.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how it unfolds, because they're basically, it was like when BLM was slagging off white people, it was okay, but now you've gone near Jews, that's too far. And it will be interesting to see how they respond to it. And also, all the big brands that have come out in support of BLM, do they now support this? Do they support Palestine over Israel?
This is something that you really need to bring up with Yorkshire Tea, for instance.
Yeah, well, I actually retweeted BLM and said, WTF, I love Yorkshire Tea again now. But I don't know, we'll see what happens. Premier League as well, the whole Premier League Football League has supported BLM. Do they support this as well? So,
I think everybody who's come out in favor of BLM in the UK needs to be asked that question. In fact, if you are in the UK or you're anywhere in the world, frankly, there are lists of companies. They're great lists. They're handy for boycotting companies, but they're also handy for harassing these companies. Companies that support BLM. Find these lists. They're on Twitter. Go to all the UK ones, the UK institutions, the teams, etc., and say, do you support Palestine? And get them, you're going to be causing a lot of sweating and arguing and worry, you know, in the boardrooms of these companies, because they can't not support Black Lives Matter, right? Yet they know what lives really matter the most. So yeah, this is great. I love it when our enemies get tied in knots like this. Somebody writes in, best of British, can't wait to donate to Patriotic Alternative. Chana writes in, Laura Towler works 70 hours a week for us and averages $3 an hour. Support her at subscribestar.com. Laura-Towler. Yes, go and support Laura's work. We haven't even talked about your YouTube work recently, but let me just find a few more things on here. Then I want to talk about a wonderful example of another establishment self-own in the UK. This is a particular skintellectual of South Asian extraction who is adamant that white lives don't matter. So let's get into that in a minute, but I just want to find if there are any more questions about it. Somebody says, start a revolution for us. Yeah, we'll do that. That's what we're up to. So this is great. I think I've gone through most of the ones. So yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the UK and the double standards in the establishment. If you say white lives matter, you're going to lose your job. Your girlfriend is going to lose her job. If you say white lives don't matter, what happens to you in the UK?
Yeah, so this was a lady called Priyamvada Gopal, I think I'm pronouncing that right. She's an intellectual at Cambridge University, which, as you know, is one of the two big universities in the United Kingdom, along with Oxford. It's actually a world famous university. And she tweeted out, I'll say it again, white lives don't matter. And then she also tweeted, abolish whiteness. She received so much hate for this, like, as to be expected, you know, for saying white lives don't matter. Cambridge University actually promoted her for saying that to a full professorship. So if you say white lives don't matter, you get promoted. If you fly in a banner saying white lives do matter, then you get fired from your job and your girlfriend gets fired from her job and you get attacked, etc., etc. So I know we were talking about this before we went live, but, you know, they have this narrative of systemic racism. But time after time after time again, we're constantly shown that it's actually the opposite of what they say. This woman she's just horrible. If you go and have a look at her Twitter, I think she got suspended from Twitter, but then they gave her account back. So Twitter would like to keep this up. Just a horrible, hateful, resentful person.
Yeah, and this is the white privilege that we enjoy, right? Britain is a white country. Cambridge University was created by white people. Cambridge University now employs and promotes and stands by this hateful South Indian or South Asian Indian woman who hates white people. And somehow white people are privileged in the UK. They're privileged to pay for this person. They're privileged to have themselves denigrated by this person. And they're privileged to not enjoy full legal protection in a country filled with non-whites who are being taught by the establishment to hate whites and to blame them for all of their ills. That's what white privilege amounts to. And it's such a threadbare false claim. And again, this is a wonderful opportunity to point this stuff out to people who are just now noticing. So we're in interesting times. These are times that we can really, really benefit from. Made in Cornwall just donated a lemon. Cinewolf donated a Ninjagini and asked, did you see Labour Party politician Rebecca Long Bailey sacked for, quote, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory? Do you have anything to say about that, Laura?
Yeah, so I think she'd said something about the police in America being funded or trained by Israel or something like that. And it's one of these things where the media just call it a conspiracy theory, like our demographic replacement is a conspiracy theory. And they never say, you know, it's true because of this or it's not true because of this. But she was fired by Sir Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, for being anti-Semitic, because when he became the leader, in his first speech, he said that his number one priority was sorting out the relationship between the Labour Party and British Jews. You know, not the white working class, not the thousands of English girls who have been raped by Pakistanis, but it's making sure that Jews are happy, not 0.5% of the electorate. So she'd said this, which was apparently a conspiracy theory, and she got sacked for saying it. The left were kind of divided on it because some people were saying, good, that's anti-Semitic, she should have been fired. And then the rest of the left were saying, we should be able to criticise Israel without that meaning that you hate Jews. So again, this is another example of them kind of arguing and fighting between themselves. But you made your bed, so lie in it, I guess. And she's not a nice person. She's anti-white. So I don't feel sorry for her.
Yeah, well, the fact that it is true that this police officer and the hold that he used, or the knee on the neck technique with George Floyd, that is an Israeli thing. That's an Israeli thing. And American police are being trained in Israel. And it's just a fact. And it's not an anti-Israeli statement, really. It's an anti-American statement when you get right down to it. But you can't say anything about Jews, that even things that are true, that might not be flattering to them at the moment. They will brag about training American police when it suits them, right? But if you have the wrong feelings along with those facts, then suddenly you're to be canceled, which is what this woman had to suffer. So yeah, it's absolutely true that a lot of these police techniques that are being used in America today are used in Israel and are used to subdue Palestinians, basically, in Israel. It's a hate fact. Cinewolf said, yeah.
It was very clear how Keir Starmer was going to behave as the leader of the Labour Party, because like I said, in his first speech, he said that his priority was British Jews. His wife is Jewish, and I think they're raising their children Jewish. And, you know, she didn't say anything bad, but I don't feel sorry for her, like I said. But I feel like he just wanted to make an example out of somebody to sort of like say, like, look, Jews, I'm on your side. So I just expect more and more of it to come.
Tell us a bit about your work on YouTube.
So I started my YouTube channel about a year and a half ago, and I was doing a bit of writing before that. So I was writing at Defend Europa and a couple of other places, and I just thought I'll try making some videos so that I can reach more people. I think I have 54,000 subscribers on YouTube. I've been demonetized, but my channel's still up. They always delete my videos or put them into a limited state, but I'm still there for now. And I just make videos for normies. So I don't think someone like you, Greg, would go to one of my videos and learn much, unless you wanted to find out about what was happening in the UK. But my aim really has been to make sort of 5 to 10 minute videos that people can send to their friends and family members just to help to wake them up, you know, about things like something that David Lammy said, or something that Ash Sarkar has said, or something that the BBC's done that's anti-white. I talk a lot about identity, so what it means to be English and British, and I also talk a heck of a lot about demographics and us becoming a minority in Britain and why that's a bad thing. But yeah, my channel seems to be going well. Like I say, I have over 50,000 subs, and I upload a video every Sunday morning, so I'm going to keep doing it until I get suspended, and then I'll just make videos for BitChute, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I've tried to stop using the word YouTuber now because, well, YouTube doesn't deserve it, frankly, and more of the best people don't have a platform on YouTube. I'm glad you're still there, and I'm glad you're testing their boundaries. You're not pulling your punches just to stay on there like some people have. Let me go through a couple more questions that have come in through Entropy, and we will talk about those. So MP writes in, was Roger Scruton our guy? Laura, Roger Scruton was one of your fellow countrymen. So what are your thoughts on him?
So I don't know too much about Roger Scruton, to be honest. I haven't read much of what he did, but I think he was somebody who advised the Conservative Party, and I think they fired him, and then a lot of people kicked off about it, so they ended up rehiring him again. But he wasn't extreme or anything. You know, I wouldn't say that he was a nationalist either. I mean, I don't know if he was behind the scenes. He's passed away now, hasn't he? So I think a lot of elderly people kind of have the same views as us anyway, because that was the norm for them when they were children. But then you never hear them speaking about race and stuff publicly. So I'm not 100% sure about him, to be honest, because I'm not that familiar with his work. Do you know much of him, Greg?
Yeah, I started reading Roger Scruton when I was an undergraduate, and he published a huge amount of stuff. And I read him as an undergraduate. What were the first things I read by him? I read his little book on Kant, his little book on Spinoza. He was a philosopher, a philosophy professor. And I read his book called Sexual Desire. And I thought they were all really interesting books. And so over the years, while I was in graduate school and since graduate school, I would be picking up books by Roger Scruton. He wrote a lot on aesthetics, on the aesthetics of music, aesthetics of architecture. He wrote some books on Wagner. I'm a big Wagnerphile. And I always respected him. He was a clear writer. He had a great mind. I don't know if there are any positions that I hold that are Scrutonite, right, or anything like that. I don't even know quite what his philosophy was. And I know where he sort of stood generally in kind of a German idealist tradition and a conservative. And I learned a lot from him over the years, and it was saddening to hear that he died early this year. He had cancer. He was in his 70s. Again, it's very, very upsetting to me when people who are very productive and have their hearts in the right place die when they could have decades more of productive life ahead of them. The most recent example of this was Charles Kraft, the artist from Seattle, who is a good friend of mine. He died at 72 on the 12th of this month. His father lived to be 98, but he had cancer, and he was taken well before his time. He had the most amazing imagination. He was a totally fearless person. He was definitely our guy and quite open about that. So that was a sad loss. But Scruton was more, I think, establishmentarian. I do think that he understood the value of nationalism and populism to some extent, but he also realized that there are all kinds of tripwires that would have prevented him from being published and so forth. And I think that he tried to steer clear of those. He bungled into something. Well, actually, he didn't. He was just lied about, which got him fired from this advisory position with the Conservative Party. I think his work is useful to us, but he's not really a racial nationalist. He gets people fairly close to that in some ways, but he doesn't go all the way. And so I recommend him definitely if you're interested in political philosophy. He's written about conservatism. He's written about the history of philosophy. He's written a ton of stuff, many books on aesthetics. And his work on aesthetics, for me, I think had the most influence just because it was very, very helpful in helping me cultivate myself as somebody who recognizes the beauty in things. And that's a huge part of having a good life, is just seeing the beauty in things. So let's go to Thin Red Line. Thin Red Line donates another $15. Thank you for all you do. So thank you very much again. And Gaddius writes in with $10. There's rumblings about making July White History Month, Independence Day, moon landing, etc. Laura, what do you think about having White History Month?
Well, it's interesting that you said July, because it's also Indigenous People's Day in July, which is one that we were planning on jumping on Patriotic Alternative, because it's all about the Pygmies and the Maori and stuff like that. But you're not allowed to talk about Indigenous Europeans. In fact, it's
unless it looks like Cheddar Man, right?
Yeah. Oh, God. I can't imagine how much we're going to hear about Cheddar Man on that day. But we were thinking about jumping on that hashtag on Indigenous People's Day and talking about how, you know, as Northwest Europeans, we're the indigenous population of Britain. So maybe July could be a good month for that. And there's like this pause calendar that you have to go around every single year. We have Pride Month, which was a day and then a week, and now it's a month. But it's actually about 3 months, because the Pride events take place in different cities over a three-month period over summer. So we have like a quarter of the year, which is celebrated for Pride, which is, you know, people walking down the street wearing leather and singing to It's Raining Men and all that stuff. It's just a nightmare. We have Black History Month. We have about 2 million Holocaust Memorial Days. It's just every day there's something. So I think it would be fantastic to have a month or even just a day to celebrate being proud of being white and, you know, being proud of your history and stuff. But they would never allow it. But I think enough people would support it if we could get it to catch on.
Yeah, I would just like to have White History Year, frankly, right? But yeah, they just definitely wouldn't want White History Year. But it's really true. We should have White History Year. And in fact, we did have White History Year. We had a year where every month there was some holiday, some day that we would commemorate to celebrate a battle. The birthday of a person, something like that. Things in the religious calendar, the passage of the seasons, and so forth. And I wouldn't want to confine it to white just 1 month. We really need to embrace our entire tradition. And to say that we have White History Month is to basically place it on the par with Black History Month. Well, I don't want to put white people on the par with black people in our own homelands. That's not a good idea. That's what we're trying to resist. I do think it's a great idea as a kind of troll, though, to have White History Month, but I would not put it in summer for this reason. I would put it during the school year, right? Because that creates all kinds of opportunities to demand that the schools celebrate White History Month. So it would be best if it were not sometime in the summer, because you want the schools to be in session. I think as a troll, it's a good idea. It's not something that I really wholeheartedly support. I want White History Year. But honestly, when we have our own homelands, that's what we're going to get. We'll get back White History Year. And blacks, you know, they should have their own homelands where they have Black History Year, year in and year out. That's what it is to be at home somewhere, right? Is to look around you and see your identity and your values reflected back to you by your architecture, by your manners, by the advertising, the art, the statues and things that you have in public. That's what it is to have a land that feels to be at home. And one of the things that's most insidious about this idea of white privilege is the following. And this is the topic of the speech that I was arrested so I couldn't give in Norway. The very idea of white privilege. There's this famous article about white privilege, which basically goes through this long list of things that we're supposed to hang our heads in shame about as unjust privileges that white people enjoy. And a lot of these privileges are just things that you'd expect if you have a homeland. So people in the barbershop know how to cut your hair. The music that you hear on the streetcar or that you can buy in the store reflects your ethnic group. This is what everybody should have. Everybody should have a homeland. Everybody should feel at home, not just in their own houses, but in their streets, in public places, public squares. When they go to movie theaters and things like that, they should find movies in their own language. When they deal with shopkeepers, the shopkeepers should speak their language, and on and on and on. That's what it is to have a homeland. And there's nothing unjust about that. And calling it a privilege implies that there's something unjust and unfair about that. But yeah, every people can have a homeland.
It's like when they complain about, I always see articles of people complaining about people not being able to pronounce their name, you know, stuff like that. And it's like, well, you can't expect a shopkeeper to be able to say every single name from around the globe. And also the standard of beauty. They always complain that white women are the standard of beauty in shops and on billboards and stuff. And it's like, well, the majority of the population are British, and they want to see something that they can connect with and something that they can recognise. And also, white really is the standard of beauty, I think. I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but a lot of black women do lighten their skin and straighten their hair and stuff, and a lot of Chinese women do like have surgery to make their eyes more round. And why is that our fault? Do you know what I mean? It's like they complain at us because people look up to us. And then also with the diversity quotas, they're always complaining in Britain about there not being enough black TV shows, you know, and black films and stuff. But rather than them just making their own films, they expect us to just cast black people in roles in white films. And I just feel like they want us to do everything for them. And it's like, stand on your own two feet and stop being victims. But I totally agree with the point that you've made about you should have a home, and you should be able to have the hairdresser cut your hair. You should be able to understand the language that everybody's speaking. And if we didn't have multiculturalism and mass open door immigration, which is what nationalists want, then you would have that too in your own country. But they don't seem to realize that.
Yeah, they want it both ways, basically. They want us to accommodate them. They don't want to accommodate us. And why should they, when they're being basically encouraged to be invaders, right? Ingrates and invaders who demand double standards and so forth. I would never behave that way in a foreign country, but these people feel entitled to do that. And in fact, they're encouraged to do that in white countries. And it's just one of the reasons why so many white people feel like we don't have a future anymore.
Yeah, and I know you spoke about this in your White Nationalist Manifesto, which I recommend to everybody, by the way. It's just such a good beginner book for somebody if they have, maybe if you're just starting to notice what's going on, but you just need an overview, a quick overview as well of the current situation, and then also solutions as well, what we can do about it. And it's just a book that I recommend to everyone. I think you did a really good job with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So how come it's okay for economic refugees to colonize us? That's a good question. White History Year is too long to sustain the memes. Yeah, but it could be, it's a lot of fun. White History Year would be a better troll. I do kind of like that. I think we should work on all of these things. Is Greg on Parler? No, I created an account. I followed one person and I just forgot all about it. What about you, Laura? Are you on that platform?
I did make an account the other day because everybody else seemed to be making one, but I haven't actually logged in since I made it. So I think people have been saying that you can't trust it because you can't delete your account or something, and they want people to send ID in order to verify their account. So I would maybe just be a little bit cautious and look into that. But I don't know. I can't even be bothered with Twitter half of the time. So to run two platforms, I don't know.
Yeah, I never really did much on Twitter at all because I had Facebook, and the idea that I would be shuttling back and forth and investing any time at all in two social media things just seemed vaguely dystopian to me. But last year when they deplatformed me entirely from Facebook, I'm not allowed to have friends. According to Mark Zuckerberg, I can't have friends anymore. I started putting a little more time into Twitter. And it was hilarious. We had set up a Twitter account on the day that Countercurrents went online more than 10 years ago. And my business partner at the time just sort of set it up so that everything that I put on Facebook would go on Twitter. And so I think it was about 5 years into the life of our Twitter account before I actually logged in to the Twitter account myself and found that I had sent out hundreds and hundreds of tweets, right? More than a thousand, several thousand by then. And I started looking at it. But again, Facebook was enough, right? So I didn't want to be extremely online. But now I put a little more time into it. And well, really the lockdown was when I started putting more time into Twitter. I couldn't go to concerts anymore, stuff like that. Yeah. And I was feeling frustrated, and suddenly stupid stuff that showed up on Twitter, it's like, I'm going to respond to this, right? Well, my Twitter following has now grown considerably, and it started growing earlier this year. It had been stagnant for years and then started growing because I was putting more time into it. And then it really grew in the last month, basically because of all this BLM stuff going on. So yeah, that's so I'm at 18,937 followers now. It took months. Months would go by before I would move up just 100 followers, right? It took years would go by before I'd blow past 1,000. And then earlier this year, I had maybe 15,000 followers. Now I'm close to 19,000, and almost 3,000 of those have happened in this past month.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, because everybody that I speak to is saying that over the last month or so, they've had a lot of increase in their followers or subscribers, whatever platform we're discussing. And I know I have, and Mark has as well. Our YouTube channels have gone up a lot recently. I think I was speaking to Way of the World, was it, as well, who said that his were going up. And obviously it's just, I think people are just looking for someone to talk to about what's going on, and they're maybe Googling nationalism or Black Lives Matter or whatever. In fact, I actually did a stream on my YouTube channel this afternoon, and I usually get about 800 people watching. Today I had 1600. I had double the amount of people watching, and I was like, what's going on here? But yeah, actually I've managed to red pill my sister over this whole BLM thing as well. She's never been interested in politics. She's 2 years younger than me, not interested at all. But then when the statues came tumbling down, she was like, right, I've had enough of this. Tell me what nationalism is. And she was asking me questions like, what does left wing and right wing mean? What does virtue signaling mean? What does MSM mean? You know, mainstream media. So it's really sort of basic stuff. But if somebody like my sister can become interested in politics, then anybody can become interested in politics. So it's such a white pill. I don't think they realize what a gift they've given us with all this.
Yeah, I agree. In 2014, when Black Lives Matter was starting, we started noticing a wave of new people coming to Countercurrents. And I didn't even realize what it was caused by at the time. Then in 2015, with the migrant crisis, another wave of people came. People seek out answers when they have questions. And there are people with a lot of questions on their minds. And so I knew that more Black Lives Matter agitation would cause increased traffic. I knew it. I was waiting. I was rubbing my hands together in glee, waiting for this to happen. And indeed, it has been happening. And yeah, we have to go back to the basics, because these people want to know the basics. So exactly, what is virtue signaling? What is the mainstream media? What are these outrageous double standards that they're seeing? How do we explain this? And this is why I've always been optimistic, even in the face of censorship. Censorship makes it hard for us to get our message out. But the main thing that's driving white identity politics isn't the work that we're doing, as valuable as that work is. The main driver of white identity politics is the intolerable situation created by multiculturalism. The left is the driver of white identity politics, in other words. And they keep doubling down. They keep pushing it. And that means that more and more people are going to be searching for us. And even though it is harder and harder for them to find us, it's not impossible. And they're still finding us. Even if we weren't able to address the public at all, the public would still wake up. the way I look at us is that we're not so much the people who first red pill them as we're like the people who help them along once they start having questions. And we provide like a finishing school for some people. And we hope to channel it in a productive direction as opposed to terribly unproductive directions like a lot of goofballs do. And also enemy agents for that matter, and government agents will try and misdirect people. So that's our role. And we can perform that role even in the face of terrible censorship because we're not driving this. That's the whole point. We believe that diversity is driving white identity politics. And so every time they up the diversity, we get new people coming in and it polarizes. It makes it harder to be in the middle. It makes it harder to be neutral. It makes it harder for people to be centrist and apolitical. It just eventually the middle of the road is where you get run down from both sides, right? And it's harder and harder for people to occupy that place now.
Yeah, I think reality does enough to set people off on their journey. You know, just things like getting the bus to work on a morning and not hearing anyone speaking English. For me, it was living in Bradford and being stared at and groped and abused and stuff by Pakistani men. Just horrible, the way that they treat women. And that sent me off down my journey, and they've created an absolute monster out of me, I guess. But we need to be there to, to welcome these people. And I think it's important as well that we have different levels. So, for example, I wouldn't send my grandma a Morgoth video because I know she wouldn't understand it. But I would send, maybe my fiance's dad, who's a bit more intellectual, a Morgoth video because I know that he would get it. So I think we need to have like different levels. You know, we've got our gateways. We've got people like the Iconoclast, who can make brilliant sort of normie-friendly videos. And then we have people like, you know, Keith Woods, yourself, Morgoth, who are more intellectual. I think we need all those different stepping stones, really, so that we can pass people from one person to the next.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about the Iconoclast. So a lot of people don't know what's happened with him recently, and I need an update. So can you tell us a bit about his situation?
Yeah, so basically he was doxxed by a guy called Mark Townsend, who writes for The Observer, which is part of The Guardian, I believe. He sent him such a smug email. He was like, "Hey, Dan," you know, like being all friendly. And then he's like, "By the way, I've got your name and I've got your address and I've got all this information about you. I'm going to dox you tomorrow. Will you make a statement?" Disgusting human being. So he was doxxed. I don't think they doxxed his address. I don't think they did. I mean, everyone knew that he was called Dan anyway, so they just doxxed his surname. And then he actually got suspended from YouTube the day before he was doxxed. So when he was in the media and people were reading this article, he couldn't respond to it. And also people couldn't actually just look him up and go look at his content themselves. He is still on BitChute, but his account is down at the minute. That's him that's taking it down. He's doing something to it and he's going to re-upload it. He's also on Telegram. He also has a magazine, the Iconoclast magazine, which is a hard copy of a magazine. You can buy an e-version as well if you want to, but that's a brilliant magazine if anyone wants to check that out. But yeah, it's just really horrible what happened to him. And this journalist who writes for The Guardian is just a horrible, horrible person. They're not journalists either, they're activists. He's actually published an article today as well trying to get BitChute, Gab, and I think it was Telegram shut down because they're harbouring extreme views. So yeah, it's really sad what happened to Dan because he's such a good lad. He's just a working class northern bloke. What you see is what you get. And he's worked consistently hard for, I think, probably 3 or 4 years. He's had his YouTube channel. He had 200,000 subs. And then they just got rid of him. He doesn't even know what rules he broke because they didn't even tell him. I'm sure you experienced that as well. We're getting suspended from YouTube. But he's not gone, Dan. He'll continue making videos on BitChute and he'll continue doing activism because he knows that he's on the right side.
Yeah, I reached out to him and asked him if he'd do an interview. And he says, "Well, I've got a lot of stuff going on right now. So I wanted to just follow up on him." Yeah, what a terrible thing. And this happens all the time. And again, if we had some kind of safety net for people like this, that would be a good thing, definitely. You know, it'd be nice to have our own little organization. If I had $1 billion, I'd put aside a couple million for this. Have our own organization that basically finds out who Antifa are and doxes them. We can dox these people right back. They live somewhere. right? And this is important because they only do this because they feel invulnerable. And if we can make them feel more vulnerable to blowback, then there will be less of this behavior. So yeah, I mean, when I was living in Seattle and getting attacked by people, the fact is that I knew who was behind this and I knew where they lived. And that sort of took a little bit of the wind out of their sails, right? Once you can level the playing field a little bit, this behavior is somewhat discouraged. And so, yeah, I would love to have an organization that basically does that kind of work where, you know, quote unquote, journalists, journophaw work, they mess with us. We can always mess with them. Some of these people are truly disgusting human beings too. And when you know the truth about them, the journalist who campaigned against Zero Hedge, turns out this guy is a plagiarist and a pedophile. Isn't that nice? God. Yeah. That's the trouble, though. It's worse being a racist than it is a pedophile in the present system.
Yeah, a lot of them turn out to have really dodgy secrets and stuff. But they, like you say, they feel untouchable. And this Mark Townsend guy, when he doxed Dan, I think he had like 20 likes on his tweet and hundreds of comments from people just absolutely furious at him. But he just doesn't reply to him. He just leaves it. He's smug. He gets away from it. He knows he's not going to get suspended from Twitter. And then the next week he releases another article because he is an activist. He's not a journalist. And there are thousands of these, the 10 a penny. So I think that I agree with you that we need to just stop taking the moral high ground because these people are playing dirty. And I think we need to give them a taste of their own medicine.
Yeah, I completely agree. There are a couple other comments that have popped up. Let me just share them. Spencer394, I have a request. I need something to help red pill my parents. They're leftists, but they've even had enough with the statues. Well, it's hard to say something general, I guess, because I don't know your parents, right? What are some thoughts that you have?
I think out of everything that I've created, the one thing that people tell me helped wake up the most amount of people is We Were Never Asked, which is the survey that we did. About 50 of us went out last year and we surveyed 2,000 members of the British public who identified themselves as being white British. And we said, how do you feel about the British becoming a minority in Britain? And 7 out of 10 people said they thought it was a bad thing. 4.8% of people said they thought it was a good thing. And then a quarter of people, 26.26%, said that they had no strong feelings or they didn't want to answer. Now, we can't show this in quantitative data, but a lot of them on the day were actually scared to answer the question. But we were still so happy that 7 out of 10 people agreed with us, because that essentially means that 7 out of 10 people are nationalists, at least, you know, if they want the British to remain the dominant ethnic group in Britain. And I think what that documentary did, which again, it wasn't just me that did it, it was a group effort, but it showed people that they're not alone and that actually we are the majority. That's not what the mainstream media will tell you, but we are the majority. But at the start of that documentary, we have all the information about demographics and what's happening to Britain from World War II to the present day. And then it goes and shows the survey and the results and stuff. And that's probably the one piece of work that I've done that the most people have said to me that helped me wake somebody up, because it just helped that person feel like they weren't alone. So I don't know if that can help the person that asked the question.
That's a good answer, definitely. If you've got one piece, it's a sort of an evergreen red-pilling piece, definitely that would be it. I think it would be good to do a follow-up after this Black Lives Matter stuff dies down a bit, if it does, and see if there's a significant percentage who have changed their mind. I think probably it's going to be 8 out of 10. Eventually, it'll be 8 out of 10.
Well, when we did We Were Never Asked, it was in August last year, and then Patriotic Alternative actually launched in September. So we didn't even have a movement then, and we managed to scrape together 50 people to help us out. So I reckon if we did that again maybe next year, I reckon we could have 200 people out on the day surveying people, and we could maybe even get 10,000 responses instead of 2,000. So it would be so good to do it again, definitely.
I think you should do that every year. I think that would be absolutely fascinating. If you could do that every year, just make that and make it one of the things that Patriotic Alternative trains people for and draws people in for. If people want to do some kind of activism, this is very, very useful. And it's, if you keep coming back at the same time every year and measuring and getting a greater and greater, you know, sample, that's actually very valuable data. And just the activism itself is good for the people who participate in it. And also it asks people, they were never asked before you, right? So that is a good red pilling thing for them. And it would be interesting also if you could follow up, if you could get contact info from the people who are not in the openly uncomfortable camp and follow up with them sometimes, see if their minds are changing. That would be gold, actually, to follow people from year to year, like these longitudinal studies, right, that take place, and see what changes they're thinking. Because if we can understand that process and see patterns in it, well, that helps us to hone our propaganda.
Yeah, and on the day as well, we didn't actually have much time because we were trying to get all the surveys filled out, but lots of people actually wanted to stand and have conversations with us. So they were like, is that what's happening? Are British people becoming a minority? Why is this happening? When did it start? Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? And we wanted to stop and have these conversations with people and red pill them, but we just physically didn't have enough time on the day. But we only dedicated a morning. So I thought next time as well, it might be nice to dedicate the whole day and then to be able to engage with these people. Obviously, we don't want to influence their decision, so we can't reveal anything until they've ticked that box and then put it away. But afterwards, when people want to talk to us, we could even just give them a business card for Patriotic Alternative and say, check out this website and see what we're about.
Or yeah, if you're doing it in a particular public place and you have like 6 or 8 people like around the town square or somewhere, right? Talking, and if people want to have a conversation, they can point to you and Mark standing over somewhere and send them over for an actual conversation. Maybe they'll actually be wanting to sign up and stuff like that. I think that would be a wonderful thing to do, actually. I think it could be very, very valuable. There are a couple questions here, and since we're running out of time, I just want to zip through them. Can Greg and or Laura recommend anyone to follow on Twitter? Laura, I'll let you answer that.
Oh, gosh. I think Morgoth is very good on Twitter, if you're not already following him. I think his username is Morgoth Lives because he was suspended and then he came back. Morgoth's very good on Twitter. Who else is good? Keith Woods is good as well. He's quite active on Twitter if you want to check him out. I mean, people get annoyed at him sometimes because they disagree with certain things that he says. But overall, I think you will find him quite an entertaining person on Twitter.
Yeah, I would agree with both of those calls. I was one of those arrogant, smug people on Twitter who for years didn't follow anybody. I know it's kind of a Twitter thing. There's some people who did that, but I didn't really use it all that much. And then I started increasing the number of people I follow. Jaden McNeil is the most recent person I followed because he, of course, has been under attack for stating something that was sort of funny and obvious about George Floyd, who was not a very good person. So anyway, I recommend him, and I have followed that. And I think, again, attacking people for saying things that are objectively funny and true is a bad look for the establishment. And if they want to keep doing that, well, that plays into our hands. So I follow Laura. I follow Mark Collett. Philosophicat, she's good. I'm just scrolling down the list, right? Carl Thorborn, I hope I said his name right. I'm getting to the end of the podcast. I'm always liking his stuff. You see him on my Twitter, so follow him. And I'm trying to think of some other people who show up regularly that I'm constantly liking. But yeah, those are a few people, definitely. So let me see if there are a couple other questions here, because we do need to wrap up in a few minutes. Innsmouth Look asked, have we seen the Kansas State Twitter incident with Jaden McNeil? Yeah, definitely. Banned from Twitter, my little brother went from normie conservatism to fully based JQ believer in 6 months. It happens, and it's happening more and more often. Commies killed 100 mil It was Jonathan Bowden who led me to Countercurrents. Well, that's great. We have a lot of his material on the site. And we have done so much to try and find recordings of Jonathan's speeches, but many of them, if they were recorded, no one's brought them forth yet. But we have as many as we've been able to get. Spencer 394, let's just wrap up a bit. Laura, why don't you, again, just tell people how they can follow your work, how they can support your work, and also what's coming up, what's next from you?
Yeah, well, I guess the two main things that I do is working at Patriotic Alternative with my friend and colleague, Mark Collett, and then also creating my own videos on YouTube and BitChute. So if you want to check out my videos, it's Laura Towler. Again, they are just normie-friendly videos, so don't expect like really big brain takes, but they are stuff that you can send to your friends and family members if you want to help wake them up. But yeah, Patriotic Alternative. If you check out the website, patrioticalternative.org.uk, if you are in the United Kingdom and you register on that website, you'll get information. Mark only sends out maybe one email per month, so you won't get spammed, but you'll get invited to all of our IRL events. So we have the camping trip coming up. We have the conference in September, which is the autumn conference, if anyone wants to come along to that. And it's IRL stuff that we're focusing on really nowadays. So just check out the PA website, I guess, of my YouTube channel. But I just want to say thank you for inviting me to your stream, Greg. And it's always a pleasure to speak to you. And as you know, I love the work that you do with Countercurrents. So yeah, keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much. I remember very, very fondly the day that we met in Copenhagen when we were kept out of the Skanza Forum by a crowd of communists. That was very, very memorable. But it actually turned out to be a really pretty good day. We got to spend time together. I got to spend time with you and some other people, including people that I was meaning to meet anyway at the event. So it all worked out quite well, and it's nice to sort of have that as a memorable start to our friendship. But yeah, I think the world of your work, and I support it. And I also, again, because this is our fundraiser, I want everyone out there who's listening, there are more than 500 of you, I'm very pleased with this, to stop being free riders, passive consumers of information on the internet. I know it's easy to do. There's all this free stuff out there. But if you want to get more involved, that is the way that you keep this free stuff coming and expand our community, expand our reach. So please go to counter-currents.com. We have updates on our current fundraiser. You can give through Entropy if you want. And you can also give through a variety of other means. We don't currently have the ability to take credit card donations except through Entropy. Entropy is our one lifeline to the credit card world, the world of convenient commerce. A lot of people support us except when it's not convenient. That's very unfortunate. Years ago, when we got deplatformed after Charlottesville from PayPal, we discovered that a certain number of people who gave donations to us through PayPal just didn't want to give donations to us if it wasn't convenient through PayPal. And that taught us a lesson. You know, if it was convenient to donate to Countercurrents, they'd do it. When Countercurrents couldn't do it, well, it was convenient for them to buy stuff on eBay, I guess. But this is why they do it to us. This is why we are constantly deplatformed, because they know that every deplatforming will shake off a few people. And that is something that can only be remedied by upping our level of intensity and commitment, right? They know that commitment, intensity is distributed on bell curves, right? There are very few people who are very, very intense. And that is a problem. And I want to end with some words from W.B. Yeats from his poem, The Second Coming. And in there, he talks about how he's in a world that's falling apart. It's basically Western civilization is collapsing into nihilism. And if he could only be alive today, 100 years later, to see how much further it's gone. But the thing that he found most disturbing, he said, the worst are filled with passionate intensity and the best lack all conviction. If you live in a society where the worst people are always wound up with passionate intensity, and the best people, the guardians of order and the guardians of goodness, lack conviction, that difference alone will be enough to destroy any civilization. There will always be people who are trying to do harm, to tear down order, to tear down statues, to create riots. A lot of these people aren't just motivated by nihilism. They don't even have a clear image of what they want to replace it all with. These people always exist. There will always be this underworld, this nihilist underworld. And if they are the only ones who have passionate intensity and the guardians of civilization, the guardians of good things don't have equal or greater intensity, they will win. And therefore, we have to up our level of intensity and commitment if we're going to beat them. And one of the ways to do that is to stop being passive, start being active, start paying for things that you get for free, start trying to make this grow, make this more powerful. We have so many more people listening now. We have so much greater reach, and we have to close the deal with more and more people. That means we have to stay online. And we have to stay online, and we have to have more people working for us. Laura would love to have a staff, right? Imagine what we could do if we weren't just volunteers, if we actually had full-time paid activists. We could do so much. Somebody tweeted this out. This was after Hillary Clinton was defeated. And I just loved it. It was a great tweet. It was so 2016. The tweet was, imagine having the entire media, academic establishment, and business establishment on your side and still losing. That's what's happening with these people. They have the whole establishment and they're still losing. And there are so few of us, and so many of the best of us are doing this part-time with one hand tied behind our back, right? Like Laura and Mark are doing. What if we could do this full-time? They're still losing against so few of us, and we're doing it with one hand tied behind our back. So support Countercurrents, support Patriotic Alternative when they start going into the fundraising mode. Support Laura through Subscribestar, and you'll have us fighting with both fists on your side. So I want to thank you, Laura, for joining me, and I want to thank everyone out there for joining us. And we're going to be doing these every week. We're still trying to figure out who's going to be on next week. I was trying to get Jim Goad on, but there might be a conflict. So stay tuned, but we will be back a week from today with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.